Welcome to the Spiritual Lifestyle Podcast, formerly known as Chapters of Motherhood. I'm your host, Veronica Moss, and I've returned with an evolved vision. I'm currently in studio passionately crafting brand new episodes set to officially debut in the spring of 2024. We now focus on promoting spiritual growth in all areas of life, including career, relationships, and mindful parenting. While you're waiting for the new season to kick off, why not revisit some of the classics? We've got your favorite episodes from Chapters of Motherhood lined up for your enjoyment. So sit back, relax, and let the Spiritual Lifestyle Podcast lead you on a journey of self-discovery and growth. Stay tuned. Welcome to your renewed spiritual sanctuary, the Spiritual Lifestyle Podcast. Chapter 20, Chiropractor Mom and Route 91 Survivor. Welcome everybody back to Chapters of Motherhood Podcast. Today I am joined with my family chiropractor, Dr. Amanda Peterson. Welcome, Dr. Amanda.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you for making time for me. I know you're very busy. I also wanted to mention that you were actually there for the birth of little Grace.
I was indeed. It was such a beautiful birth and it was such an honor to be there. It actually was my first birth that I was in the room for at the birth center.
Oh, okay. I would have thought that you would have had experienced more births being at the birth center, but wow, I'm pretty proud that I was one of your first.
You were my first. I have been inside my office, being inside the birth center for 3 years. I was at the birth center for many births, but not in the room for very many. So it was such an honor to actually be there when Grace actually came into the world.
Well, I definitely appreciated it for sure. So you're a mom to a boy.
Little boy, Jason. He's 8.
Can you go ahead and talk about your motherhood journey?
Absolutely. I love being a mom. It's absolutely the best thing I've ever done. Of all of the things in my life, it has definitely been the hardest, but the best. It's brought me more joy than anything I could ever imagine. But as most of us moms know, it's not easy. We always, you know, dream about being a mom and think about all the glamorous, wonderful things. And then reality hits and we're like, whew, this is really hard. Mm-hmm. So I always knew I wanted to be a mom. I love kids. I love caring for kids. In high school, I wanted to be a social worker. I just wanted to help kids. That's where my passion and my calling was. But then as I shadowed some different social workers as a teenager leading up to graduation of high school, I realized that it's not exactly how I wanted to help kids. It's not what I was feeling called to do. So I struggled with a different career paths and started doing my general ed through my undergrad. And one day I just woke up and said, I'm going to be a chiropractor. My older brother, Keith, is a chiropractor. And watching him just change lives really hit me. I thought, oh man, I would love to do that. I could really make a difference. But then I doubted my ability to do it. I thought, oh, maybe I'm not smart enough. Chiropractic school is really hard. But then I just decided I'm going to do it. So that's how I ended up being a chiropractor, is I just decided this is how I'm going to do it. And it was definitely a struggle, you know, becoming a chiropractor. And school is very intense. We usually start about 7:20 in the morning and end about 4:30 in the afternoon. And it's all day, every day, 5 days a week. And in weekends, we're, you know, in labs and studying and, you know, taking national boards and getting licensed. It was rough. But then I had a son and I thought, yep, this is definitely harder. Mm-hmm. being a mom is so great, but it's definitely a lot of work. And I wanted to have a baby. I did plan to have a baby and I didn't have the best of pregnancy. You think, oh, I know everything, you know, this is what I do. This is my line of work. I work with pregnant mommies and babies, and I'm going to rock this pregnancy. And then I was sick as a dog. I couldn't get out of the house to go anywhere. And I could only eat what I craved, and that changed from moment to moment. Very hard. I wasn't as active as I was after being pregnant, and I put on a lot of weight, and I struggled to work. Just everything was harder than I had thought. And I watched all of these, you know, pregnant mommies come in and out of my office and they make it look so good. They make it look so easy. They all look so beautiful and happy. And I was miserable. And I realized that in taking care of all of my patients, I wasn't taking care of myself. And so as we know now, good nutrition plays a huge role into the type of pregnancy you have and making sure you're getting the right nutrients and taking the right vitamins. So I didn't have a good pregnancy. I didn't have the best of birth, but I want to share about my birth story because this is exactly why I do what I do, is because my birth was, it was very difficult. I went in headstrong with a birth plan. I didn't have the contacts I have now. So my pregnancy, during my pregnancy, I didn't know all of the people that I know now. Now I have best friends that are doulas and midwives, and I could deliver anywhere with anyone that I wanted, but I was new to California when I had my son, and I didn't have those contacts. So I delivered at a hospital, but I did have a doula, and, you know, my ex-husband and I, we did this together with my doula, and my mom was here, but she wasn't in the room with us. But my birth went from completely natural to every intervention possible within a very short amount of time. And that's why I want to touch on this, because we all choose to birth the way we choose to birth, and that's completely fine. But when you have a birth plan and you have an end goal, it's very important to make sure that you choose the avenues for what you want. So when you go in for your birth and you're going in to have your baby, your end goal, whatever that may be, you want to make sure that you have hired the right people, chose where you want to birth correctly, your support system, your support family, all of that is absolutely important. Because what happened is that I went into the hospital to have my baby, and my doula said, okay, I think it's time to go. I think you're getting close to transition or in transition, and we should go. And we lived about 8 minutes from the hospital at the time. And let me tell you, that is the longest 8 minutes of my life. Mm-hmm. Transitioning in the car to the hospital was very, very rough. And when we got there, I thought, well, even on the way there, I thought, oh my God, I'm going to have this baby in the car. He is going to come out right now. And that is the feeling that I had. And I thought I was doing great. I thought I was a rock star. I thought I was getting through it. And I thought, well, I'm going to get to the hospital and he's going to come right out. And I get there and I'm about 9.5 centimeters dilated, and they stick me in triage and they are having me sign all these forms, but they separate me from my ex-husband and my doula and my mom, and they're not letting me have access to any of my support. And they're telling me, you've got to sign all these forms and answer all these questions. And I'm losing my mind. I'm thinking, this is outrageous. So you can't take a woman who is almost fully dilated and stick her away from all of her support. And so they just hand you a stack of forms to sign. And they're like, oh, here, sign these. We'll be right back. And as I'm thumbing through them quickly and pacing, you know, and working through all my contractions that are really on top of each other, I find all these forms. Like, I'm consenting for them to do all these things to my baby, to give my baby all these injections. It's just their normal protocol. But it didn't align with my views and my birth plan. And I'm thinking, this is not informed consent. This is not okay. So I signed what I had to, just, you know, for the delivery, but they had me sign a consent for C-section, or they asked me to, in the stack of papers they handed me. And I'm thinking, I don't think I'm having a C-section. Why would they hand me all this stuff? So I realized in that moment, I'm like, this is not going to go the way I need it to go. So I'm going to have to be very strong, and I'm going to have to tell my doula and my ex-husband when we get back together, and my mom, that when they allow us to be together again, they're going to have to be the ones that stand firm with my birth plan, because I thought this is not going to go well. So it took a lot of screaming on my part in the hallway for me to get out of triage, because they must have been busy. It wasn't anything. It was a priority for them. They were definitely just kind of like leaving me there for quite a while. And when I finally got into the room, and then they were like, okay, let's check you. Let's get your IV started. Let's do all of this. And I'm thinking, I just handed you all my birth plan. I don't want to be messed with. Just leave me alone. I'll just push this baby out. And so I'm working through my contractions, and luckily I'm able to squat and do what I need to do in the position that I need to do it in, which is it's not very common that they let mommies do that, but I just decided I'm not getting in any position I don't want to get in. So the doctor comes in and checks, and it's not my regular OB, just an OB that happens to be on call. And she's like, oh, yep, you know, you have a little bit of a cervical lip, but you're pretty much fully dilated. So let me reduce your cervical lip, and then I'll check back with you in a few hours. And I'm thinking to myself, what? What do you mean you'll check back in a few hours? Didn't you say I was fully dilated? And right. She was like, you know, your baby's still kind of high. So you'll just need to work him down, and I'll be back and check on you in a little bit. I'm just going to go back over to the clinic. And I'm thinking, no way. No way. What do you mean high? I'll squat. I'll do some more of this. And I'm thinking to myself at that moment, here I am, a provider for pregnant mommies, and I have no clue what the birth process looks like. I have no idea, you know, going into this, what I was going to be faced with. And I now know that adjusting all the way up until a week before I had my son, it affected the way my pelvis was sitting and it was aligned, and my son wasn't in a great spot. So even though I had been fully dilated for a little bit, my son was still very high. So I continued to squat and work him down and do what I had to do. And it just, in his position, never changed. So the short version of my delivery is I consented to an epidural, which didn't go well. It was botched. And the first time the anesthesiologist hit my vertebrae, so then went two levels above his initial spot. And then I was able to get about 20 minutes of relief from the epidural, but then I started getting very sick and I started vomiting. And then I thought, there's no way. I kept trying to push him down. And now I'm on my back instead of squatting. And I thought, this isn't going to happen. And so the OB would check in every so often. And I think I was fully dilated for 12 hours before I actually had him. And that's why I'm saying, when you think you know birth and then you experience it and you're like, I have no idea what's going on in this profession and these mommies I'm taking care of and I'm giving advice to. And I had no clue what they were up against. But I think that my birth journey is important for me to know now how to help each mom get through what they need to get through. So I ended up having a cesarean after being dilated for 12 hours. It wasn't an emergency at the moment, but became an emergency really quick. So I had been taken down to the OR. I was waiting in line. I was told I was signed up and I was waiting in line. Since my baby wasn't in distress, we were just waiting. But I was extremely ill from the epidural. And at this point, I think I had the epidural about 9-10 hours, maybe, because I was fully dilated for, well, I should say about 8. I think I was fully dilated for about 4 hours. Then I consented to the epidural. And then I decided, okay, well, the only way to get him out now is going to have to be a C-section. So I'm waiting in line and everything is fine. And I get down to the OR and they go in to give a spinal tap since my epidural wasn't working. And because the anesthesiologist who gave me my epidural didn't do a great job, they had to go four spinal levels above the initial injection of my first epidural that was botched. So when they gave me my spinal tap and laid me down, strapped me down, my ex-husband was waiting in the hallway for them to put me, you know, get me prepped, and then they were going to call him in. But they strapped me down, and all of a sudden I can't breathe. And I'm shaking my head and I'm flailing the best I can, strapped down. And they're saying, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I said, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And they're like, oh, well, you're talking, but I wasn't getting a lot of air out at this point. I'm barely saying many words. My mouth's moving, but words aren't coming out. And they kept saying, well, say your name. And at that point I had run out of air and I couldn't say my name. So all I know is people are ripping my glasses off my face and smacking my face and putting bags over my face. And the first bag that they had put over my face, they didn't turn on the oxygen. So I'm screaming and just shaking my head. But after that, I don't remember much. I just remember waking up in recovery. So I ended up having general anesthesia. And my son's father, my ex-husband, wasn't able to witness his birth. He was able to hear him cry from the hallway. And then he was able to go with him to the nursery while I was in recovery. But I went from having, you know, a completely natural birth and being fully dilated without any medication to an epidural, a spinal tap, general anesthesia, and a C-section. And that was hard because I thought, I'm going to be this rock star mom who knows all this information about birth because this is what I do and the mommies that I serve, to having all of the interventions at once.
Right. What did they attribute for you that you weren't breathing? What happened there? Was it something to do with the
the spinal tap because they had to give my spinal taps 4 levels above the initial injection from the first epidural, because you can't just inject in the same area. You have to usually go 2 levels above. So since the first injection, he didn't hit the epidural space, he hit my vertebrae, he had to go 2 levels above to give me the second try of the epidural. And then when they gave me my spinal tap, they had to go 2 levels above that. So it paralyzed my diaphragm. And so when they laid me down and strapped me down, I wasn't able to breathe.
Okay. And they had to put a breathing tube so that you could be under general anesthesia. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they had knocked me out pretty quick. So I don't remember any of that, but it's intense.
Oh, well, I'm sorry that you went through that you had your plan and it had to be changed.
Very quickly. And so, I mean, obviously, motherhood, that's motherhood, right? Those are the...
Right. You have plans, but... You have plans, but it doesn't always work out the way you want it to.
It doesn't. Right. I think God and our children laugh at us. They're like, oh, mom, you have a plan? Let me change that for you.
Yeah, exactly.
So okay. I went from having what I thought was going to be an easy natural birth to a very medicalized birth. And so that fueled my fire to be an even better chiropractor, because my life had changed in many, many ways. I had become a mom, but then I had experienced firsthand what all of these patients who trust me with their lives and their families' lives, I have experienced what they had already experienced, but in such a different way. And so I wanted to make sure that I shared my story and my journey of birth, because that would empower all of my mommies to want something better for them. So I only have one child. I only birthed one child, but I feel like in a way it's a blessing that I got to experience everything, because now I get to better serve all of my mommies. So if I have mommies who come in and they have a natural birth, I can't say that I pushed a baby out of my lady parts, but I tried for 12 hours and that makes you really sore. So right. I had that part of that experience. And then I had the part with an epidural, you know, where I got about 20 minutes of relief. And so I know what the pushing with an epidural feels like. And then I know what pushing with a botched epidural feels like when the initial medication wears off and then you're very sick from the medication. And then I got to experience a spinal tap for just a moment. Mm-hmm. And then also general anesthesia and a C-section. So recovering from having my baby was extremely rough. I didn't, like I said, I can't say that I had the vaginal birth part, but I had a lot of soreness from trying to push for 12 hours. And I had to recover from a surgical birth. And so having soreness in two places was kind of rough. It was really rough. And trying to figure out motherhood on top of it. Just like our birth experiences, we think we know what we're doing. We think, oh, I know what I'm going to do, and my baby is going to do this, and my baby's not going to do that, and I'm not going to do this, and I'm not going to do that. And all of that goes out the window, just like our birth plan does sometimes.
Right. What's that saying? That saying that goes, you're the perfect parent until you have children?
Exactly. I was a great mom. I was a great mom fill-in. I was a great nanny.
Right.
And I was a great provider for all of my children, but not so much a great mom at first. You know, I just remember sitting at the end of my bed, rocking my baby, you know, with the postpartum hormone surge. And then we have the instant decrease and depletion of all of those hormones. And I just remember sitting at the end of my bed, rocking my baby and crying hysterically. And my mom is looking at me like, are you okay? What is going on? Right. And I was telling her, I'm like, does he know I love him? Does he know how much I love him? Can he feel it? And mm-hmm. my mom was like, he looks happy to me.
But I mean, that's all normal feelings. What you go through is just experiencing for the first time. And your mom probably forgot, like, oh yeah, I went through that.
I think so. And sometimes I wonder though, with just the change in times and the change of society, I think now with social media and with, you know, Pinterest and Etsy, I feel like there's a little bit more pressure on us moms nowadays to make everything perfect and supposed to be perfect because everyone makes it look perfect. So I'm sure all of our moms have experienced something very similar to that. But now I'm like, well, I want to know that he feels my love. And it's like, well, he's happy and he's smiling and he's thriving. So that's how we know that they're loved and that they feel loved, but he couldn't tell me that. So I wanted to make sure. But I think you're right. All of that's normal. And I think that's a huge part of what the message I want to send too, is that we forget what normal is. And we have all these labels nowadays. Like, we have the label of postpartum depression and postpartum anxiety, or, you know, all of these other things that we go through. And I don't think it's postpartum depression at all. I think it's just postpartum. I think there are definitely different levels of it. And I think some of us may struggle a lot more than others. And sometimes medication is needed. A lot of times therapy is needed, because adjusting to a huge life change, no matter what it may be, it's not easy. And I don't think anybody should do it alone. And at the time, I had my spouse and my mom, so I wasn't home alone. And I was doing okay. But then I would just be sitting and think all of a sudden, like, oh, I'm not doing a good job. I'm not taking good care of him. And I think that's a huge part of some of our social media too today, is that, you know, not all of us show the messy parts of our house, you know, or, you know, the crying that we do at night after we put our kids to bed, because it was just such a rough day. And I feel like that's definitely part of why God called me to help change lives in this way, is because while I'm working on my mommies and my babies, I can tell these stories to my families, and everyone can chuckle and laugh like, oh, yeah, I've been there. I've been rocking my baby crying and making sure, you know, do you know I love you? Am I taking good care of you? And all kids are different, and all kids are going to respond to things differently and may need a little bit of different things. But in the end, all they want is to be taken care of. And as long as we're doing that, then we're doing a good job as a mom.
Yes, exactly. As long as you're responding to their needs, they don't care. They don't care if you, what you smell like, what you look like, how your hair is, you know, they don't care if you bait either.
They
as long
care
as
at
their
all.
Needs are being met. And that's what moms do. Like, we always put that baby's needs first.
Absolutely.
And I think you're right. There is a lot of pressure with social media. And I have noticed that there is a movement to normalize not okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that just happened with Meghan Markle, the Duchess, where she's, you know, holding back her tears and saying, thank you for asking. Not a lot of people ask if I'm okay. And it just shows you, it's like, it doesn't matter if you're, you know, living in Buckingham Palace or if you're just a mom in an apartment. We're all going through the same thing when we're struggling with becoming a mom for the first time.
It's a lot. Yes. And even, you know, I can't speak to it like you can, of course, but not even just the first time.
Right.
I mean, the second baby, the third baby, they're all different. And we all go through different stages at different times. So it's very possible that the first baby is easy. And then, you know, or this first pregnancy or birth or baby is easy. And then we have a second or a third, and they're nothing like the other one was for us. And
nothing.
So I hear that a lot. And even just your story you've told me, it means so different. And so even just, you know, a lot of times, kind of like the false reality that I had, like, oh, I take care of moms and babies, so I'm going to rock this birth and I'm going to rock motherhood because I know what I'm doing. And I nannied three boys, you know, and I did just fine. And then I had one boy and I was like, oh my gosh, I have no idea what I'm doing.
I think that's just every mom though.
I think,
you're like, I don't know what to do.
Right. I have no clue what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I think that the best advice I ever got was from my brother, my older brother, who Keith is a chiropractor. And he said, Amanda, if you think you're doing it right, you're probably really screwing him up. But if you think you're doing it all wrong, then you're doing everything right. And he's doing just great.
That's
so
true.
I think
agree.
That's the best advice for sure.
Yes, I agree.
So after having the birth that I had, you know, and struggling through the beginning of motherhood, that's when I decided to really make my focus on caring for families. I'd always been a prenatal chiropractor, but I didn't have a specialty practice. It was more general. And when mommies would come in, I would definitely care for them. But after I had my son, I dove into the birth world. I dove into birth work. I wanted to know more about how I could help mommies achieve the birth that I wanted, but didn't get. And it wasn't that my doula failed. It wasn't that my ex-husband failed. And it wasn't that my body failed. It was that I just wasn't prepared enough when things started to change and the domino effects of the medical world started to hit. I didn't know how to combat that. And so it just continued to happen. So I decided, okay, well, I'm going to start getting out there and meeting more doulas and talking with them more and helping them and having them help me. We could help educate each other on what we can do for mommies and how to get them the birth that they want, or how to educate them that they can make choices for themselves, whether they're in the hospital or out of the hospital. It was just this fire and this passion that I had that I wanted to help educate mommies more. And the bottom line was that I was caring for people up until the end of my pregnancy, until a week before I had my son, and that affected the alignment of my pelvis, which affected my baby's alignment, which didn't allow him to come down the way he needed to. So I wanted to definitely get my hands on more pregnant mommies so that I could take that away from them. I didn't want to hear of another mom having the birth that I had when it was preventable and an easy fix. But being new to California, I didn't have anybody close to me that I knew of that was a prenatal chiropractor. And in fact, I had visited a few chiropractors in the area, and one of them actually told me, oh, we don't adjust pregnant mommies. That's not safe. And I thought to myself, please don't say that to anybody, you know? And I had even told him, I'm like, I do this for a living. This is what I do. And I'm Webster certified, which is our prenatal chiropractic adjustment is the Webster technique. So I told him, I'm like, I'll walk you through it. And he was like, oh no, it's not safe. I can't do that. And so I'm looking around standing, you know, I'm like, Corona and Riverside, there are so many chiropractors. And there's not a single Webster certified doctor or even just a single doctor who's willing to adjust me as I walk him through it. And I thought, you know, I'm a licensed chiropractor. And if I can't convince another chiropractor that this is safe and to even help me, then I mean, this area is doomed. And so that's when I was like, that's it. I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to figure out how to not let this happen to a single mom. So that's when I started meeting doulas, and I actually met my friend Kate at another birth. I was at a home birth adjusting a mommy. I got called that she had been in early labor for a long time and they thought baby was in a bad position. So I had brought my portable table over and I adjusted her in the middle of the night. And her midwife was just in shock. She was like, I know that this is good, but I've just never seen this firsthand. So she and I decided to start working together and figuring out how we can help mommies have faster births and just even just the birth that they want in general, since we know that that pelvic alignment definitely affects the outcome, as I experienced firsthand. So she had invited me to come and work inside of her birth center, and I would do that a few days a week while I was working with another doctor. And then I decided, you know, my calling is with mommies. So I took the jump I decided to make the change and transition to strictly working in the birth center. And that was actually one of the best decisions I ever made, because that was what I wanted to do. That's where my passion was. I definitely wanted to make sure that my focus was on them. So I decided to do that full time. I think we did 3 days a week, and I would go into the birth center, and I ended up setting up my office permanently there, and that's where I met Veronica when she was pregnant. And we had originally had our first birth center in Corona, and then we moved into our location in Riverside. And it was just amazing to see all these different lives changed, and birth stories changed, and birth outcomes. And having had the C-section that I had, I always wanted to have a healing birth. Anytime we have a loss of any kind, the next birth or pregnancy after that, we want to make that our healing, redeeming pregnancy or birth. And so it wasn't in the cards for me to have another baby, because I ended up getting separated and divorced. So I thought, okay, well, my one child is my one child, but I wanted to redeem and heal through all of my other mommies, which is so awesome and amazing to do. So I get to see all these mommies who, you know, have had C-sections, and some were not even anything that needed to happen, though. I mean, I see mommies all the time where they were told, oh, you're too young. I had teen moms, and they didn't even let them birth. They didn't induce them. They didn't let them labor at all. They just took them straight in for a surgical birth. And I've had a couple of those moms where they weren't even given that trial of labor, and they were told they just had to go in for a C-section. And now they're pregnant again, and they're like, I don't want to do that again, but I was told I can't, or my risk is too high, or the chance of it happening and I get my vaginal birth after a C-section is very low. And I thought, wow, this is what we're doing to our moms. We're bullying them and we're giving them false information. So that is when I decided, well, I'm going to start educating my moms as I adjust them. And so when these mommies come in, I tell them, I give them resources, and I tell them what real statistics are saying about vaginal births, or, you know, vaginal births after C-sections, or first-time labors, or whatever the case may be. And the research shows that first-time moms, you know, they average labor 24 to 36 hours, and that is not fun. And chiropractic care cuts that in half most of the time. If we have enough time to adjust that pelvis and get that baby in alignment, then we can cut that down by about 50%. And my specific goal for all of my first-time moms is 10 hours and under. I want my mommies to have their babies in under 10 hours, because nobody wants to drag that out.
Right.
I don't think so.
Well, I had Grace in 3.5 hours.
Yay.
That was shocking. I went from zero pain to a level 7, like, immediately. I was like, oh my God, what is going on? And yeah, 3.5 hours. And she came out pretty quickly.
That was our goal.
Yeah. Speaking of Grace as a newborn, I remember that when I had her, you offered me to adjust her. And I honestly, confused, ignorant, didn't know. I'm like, why would a baby need adjustment? And can you let us know why a baby would need adjustment, which totally makes sense.
Absolutely. Well, the birth process is intense. First of all, if you think about how our babies come into the world, or how they're supposed to vaginally, is they come down through the vaginal canal head first. And so squeezing through mommy's pelvic bone, that's a lot of pressure. Every time the uterus contracts, we have that contraction and we push down, there's a lot of pressure on the head and neck. And while it's not permanently damaging the structures, it can cause things to shift out of place. And so if a mommy has a surgical birth, then the baby isn't coming through the pelvic bone or the vaginal canal, but they're being pulled out by their head and neck. And so their entire weight of their body is usually pulled out of the mom's abdomen by the head and neck. The doctor is grabbing them there. So that pulling and tugging and the pressure going through the vaginal canal, and then in a lot of hospital settings, babies are even pulled from the vaginal canal by their head and neck, and there's a lot of distraction. And so those misalignments that happen to the head and neck, those are done at birth, and our brain communicates to our body through our spinal cord. So if our brain is sending signals to all of our organs and cells in the body, but we have misalignments somewhere in the spine, and that signal is being altered or impeded somewhere, or maybe we're not getting that full signal. And so that at birth right there, we've already cut off the connection between the brain and the body somewhere, some way. And over time, it just gets worse. And so what we usually see is babies struggling to latch to the breast to nurse, or if they're not breastfed, if that's not mom's goal, or they're, you know, that's not an issue, then a lot of times what we see is gas and constipation or reflux or colic or constant ear infections or sinus infections. All of that is usually caused because the nervous system isn't functioning properly. And our brain and spinal cord are our nervous system. So if our spine that houses that nervous system is affected, then it will absolutely affect the way our body is functioning. So that's why I like to check babies as soon as possible, so we can clear any problems they may have. So if it's a nursing issue, or, you know, a gas issue, or constipation is something I see all the time. Constipation and reflux are probably the two most common symptoms babies have when moms bring them in. And a lot of times I hear, oh, it's okay, I read online, it's okay for babies to go 10 or more days without having a bowel movement. No way. Where would you put all of that? Think about where the baby's right. going to put all of that. They're right. so tiny, and especially breastfed babies, because they're not getting synthetic food. It's real food from us. And so they're going to tend to have a lot more waste because their body is able to discard of it faster versus synthetic food or formula. Although it is just fine, there's no shaming happening, the body may take a little bit more time to discard of that waste. But reality is babies should not go, they should definitely not go 10 days without pooping. My rule of thumb is usually about 3. So right. in the beginning, they're, you know, their bowels are changing and things are changing. But if your baby is a month or more old and they're not having daily bowel movements, then something's not right.
Yeah. And I wish I would have known that with Emily, because Emily did have a lot of acid reflux and she had constipation and she was very colicky. And I wish I would have known that back then. But with Grace, she's always had a neck issue. And I think it's because of her head. I think it's because of her head shape that she has that neck issue, because she can't just lay on her back. She has to always twist her head when she's laying down. And so that all these adjustments really do help her.
And that's so important, because, you know, most people have the same question, like, why would my baby need to be adjusted? They don't have pain. But we don't know that. We don't know they don't have pain because we can't ask them, especially as a newborn. But if they're fussing in a certain position, or they're fussing when they're trying to latch to the breast, or even just trying to take a bottle sometimes, if they're fussing with that, then that's a good indication that something's not right. And whether it be pain or irritation or discomfort, none of us want our babies to feel that. So, and that's what a lot of times we have when we try to especially latch to the breast, because the baby does need to suck so hard at the breast to pull from the hind milk forward. There's a lot of pressure wherever the misalignment may be in their head and neck. And so when we clear that, we almost immediately see a change. And I do this all day, every day. And I can tell you, every time I adjust a baby who's struggling to latch and that mom latches right after the adjustment, they tell me immediately it feels different. Mm-hmm. So it's beautiful to see that I can change that experience for someone, because I wasn't able to change that experience for myself for my birth. But now I can help these mommies and these families and these babies. I can help them thrive. I want to grow healthy families, because a lot of chiropractors out there, they fix broken people. And I do too. All of us moms are broken every day. Mm-hmm. But I don't get the average, cranky, always in pain patient. I get, you know, happy families coming in and they're like, whew, something's not right. And I can fix that up and then we're better. Instead of chasing all of these injuries, I'm growing these kids healthy from the start. And it's beautiful to watch. And I have families that, you know, I've helped them with all of their babies and all of the pregnancies. And I'm starting to feel a little old as these kids get a little older, but watching them grow into healthy kids instead of watching them struggle, it's just life changing. And so I think that that's just kind of where my calling has always been. I think that's why God has always called me to do what I do. And I think that I truly believe that all of my life experiences, you know, good and bad, or hard or easy, which not many are easy nowadays, is that it's meant to share my story with someone to help change their outcome, because we don't have a lot of support in a lot of different ways. And, you know, like you were saying, just like normalizing, it's okay to not be okay. I think that that's really important. And I think that's kind of how, you know, as my journey in life continues, I think that's where God has always been utilizing me. And I think that that's really important in motherhood and even just recovery of life in general. And I think being a shooting victim survivor, I think that that just continues my story in that same direction. And it's like, okay, well, you know, now I'm a mom who had, you know, a different birth outcome, and a chiropractor, and a single mom, and now I'm a survivor. And so I think that is, like I said, just continuing that path and what I'm supposed to be doing and what God is calling me to do. So I'd like to share a little bit about my story as a survivor and as being shot, being a single mom, and, you know, all of that playing a role into our life, because I'm learning as I recover and work through being a survivor and just my story, is that we all have our experiences, no matter what they may be. And not everyone has been in a tragic experience, but we've all had hard things that we have to work through. And so it doesn't matter how hard it may be, it definitely affects our journey. And I think how we respond to whatever hard thing that may be, I think that's going to determine our outcome in life in general.
Well, I remember 2 years ago scrolling on Instagram and seeing you posting with your cowboy boots and your hat and saying that you're in Vegas for Route 91 concert. And I thought, oh, that's cool. And I remember watching TV, and then whatever program I was watching ended, and then breaking news. There's a shooting in Vegas. And I'm like, oh my God. I turned to my husband. I'm like, oh, my chiropractor's there. And then that was it. I was like, what is going on? What's happening? Is she okay? And I tried texting you. I tried texting your assistant at the time. And well, obviously no one's going to respond to me, right? But I was like so worried. And then to find out that you were actually shot. Do you want to talk about that?
I would love to talk about that, just because it's crazy. And I truly believe that God does have a little bit of a sense of humor. And I can tell you that as a chiropractor who was shot in the back, I'm like, really, Lord, this is funny. But it's funny because I actually had a moment after being shot where I thought, oh, haha, what a coincidence. Because in a moment of terror, there's so many emotions that go through us. So I'm completely and utterly grateful for God saving my life, and absolutely no other explanation for how I survived. But I would love to share, because I know that there were a lot of people affected by this. You know, they say 22,000 people were there. And it's not just us survivors who are affected. It's all of our loved ones and our family members. And my son and my family, our lives have changed forever because of this. And so, you know, being a survivor, definitely important that we all know, just like in motherhood, that, you know, we're not alone, that whether these changes are permanent or they're good or they're bad, or it doesn't matter. It's hard. And so it's really devastating to think about, but I'm extremely grateful for just the experiences that I've had along the way, just similar to being, you know, my birth story and motherhood, is that, you know, when I was shot on the second round of bullets. So the shooting started, and we really didn't know what was going on. And Jason Aldean was on stage singing, and he like paused kind of shortly, very quickly, but then kept, you know, like you could tell everyone was kind of stunned. We didn't know what it was. And we all thought it was fireworks, and it sounded like it was pretty close. And I thought, oh, somebody's being stupid. It's the last night of the concert. And, you know, someone set off, it sounded like Black Cat fireworks to someone who doesn't, you know, shoot guns regularly or didn't know what it was. And talking to other survivors who are police officers or military, you know, they knew immediately what it was, but most of us didn't. So the first round of bullets happened, and Jason Aldean kept singing. And then the second round happened. There was a pause in between the first and second round, but then the second round happened. And that's when Jason Aldean and his band took off running off the stage, and people were screaming, you know, get down, those are gunshots, get down. So I was at the concert with my assistant at the time and her family, but my assistant had already left and gone back to the room, and I was just still at the concert with her family and only a couple of them that I knew very well. Most of them I had just met that weekend. So at the time of the shooting, we all just hit the ground, and when I looked around, I was by myself. I wasn't around anyone that I knew. So everyone scattered, and you know, I'm laying on the ground next to people I don't know, and everyone's piling on people and running and jumping and screaming. And I'm laying there, someone was laying on my legs. So I was trying to kick my legs free and try to like scoot up a little bit. And then all of a sudden it felt like the ground shook and my ears rang. And so I thought to myself, as I'm like hearing my ears ring, I'm like, what in the world just happened? And then I thought to myself, oh my God, did I just get shot? And so it's funny how they say, you know, you get that rush of adrenaline and endorphins, and so you don't always feel what's happening. And that was the case. I didn't feel anything hit me per se. But I kind of, it's kind of weird how we know where something is, but we don't. So I just happened to reach around to my back with my left hand, and my brain knew where it was, but I didn't realize at the time. And I pulled my hand back and there was blood on my hand. And I just remember screaming, oh my God, I got shot. And the people laying next to me were screaming. The lady next to me was screaming uncontrollably. And I thought, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? Oh my God, what's going to happen? And I remember just laying there. And then there was a pause. In between each round, there was a pause. And so everyone would get up and run during the pause. But I couldn't get up. I couldn't move. I couldn't feel my legs. I couldn't even sit up. Because where it was in my back, I just couldn't bend. So I remember I rolled over to my back and I just remember looking up at the sky. And that's when I kind of was joking with God. And I'm like, ha ha, God, I got shot in the back. That's kind of funny. But then I'm laying there thinking, oh my God, I'm going to die. I'm going to lay here and I'm going to die. And I'm never going to see my son again. And I started to panic a little bit. I started to just start kind of hyperventilating and panic, and I started to cry. And then I thought, nope, it's okay. You know what? If this is it, if this is all I'm going to do with life, I'm just going to have to accept it. So I laid there and I prayed and I said, Lord, please take care of my baby. If this is it, if you're going to take me home, please do it quickly. Please don't let me suffer, and please take care of my baby. And then I had this instant calming where God had calmed me down, and he may have told me I was going to be okay, but that's not anything that I heard at that moment. He just made me calm. And I thought, okay, it's all right. I'm calm and this is it. And then out of nowhere, this guy just came over and swooped me up and picked me up. And he kept saying, you know, like, can you stand up? Come on, can you get up? And I said, I can't feel my legs. So he picked me up and he basically just threw me over the center divider of the stage, because a lot of people had hopped that fence that was dividing that was going around the catwalk of the stage. And so a lot of people were hopping that fence and getting underneath the catwalk of the stage for cover, because there was really nowhere to go, nowhere to hide. So he just picked me up and threw me over. And he apologized for dropping me as he was leaving. I'm like, thank you so much. You know, and then once I hit the ground, I think that's when the pain kind of started. I started to panic again. And I think the adrenaline started to kind of wear out, where I could start feeling things now. So I immediately took my phone out of my pocket, which I'm so grateful for. I know a lot of people lost many things, but I didn't lose anything at all. So I picked my phone out of my pocket and I immediately called my boyfriend. We'd only been dating 4 months, and I went away to Vegas for girls weekend. And he was, you know, back here in California. And so I called him, and I guess he must not have heard me immediately. But he, you know, at this point, I'm pretty sure like gunfire had already started again. And he was screaming like, what are you doing? What's wrong? And I told him, I said, I got shot. And he was like, what? I said, I got shot. There's a shooting at the concert and I got shot. And I can't imagine what it feels like to be on the other end of that and to hear those words. So that's what I mean when I say it's not just survivors, but the family member of survivors. And so the long story short is that there were people underneath the stage who heard me screaming and crying, and they came out from underneath the stage. There's 5 of them: Taylor, Hannah, Nicole, TJ, and Matt. And Mike. And so they came out from underneath the stage and they picked me up and they carried me out of the venue. And being shot on the second round of bullets, I think they said there was like 11 rounds total, or something like that. They would duck and cover and hide. And, you know, we would pause when we needed to, but they got me out and they got me to area where they were doing triage, and they got me in a car and a vehicle that got me to the hospital. And these poor these poor guys and the girls, young individuals all in their 20s. None of them were married at the time or had children, and they risked their lives to save mine. And I'm incredibly grateful. And, you know, I just, all of that, I remember everything. I didn't get to see a lot because I was extremely ill. And I was vomiting and, you know, in a lot of pain, and I kept trying to put my head down and try to rest. And I wanted to go to sleep because I was in a lot of pain, but I'm really grateful that everyone was able to keep me awake. And my injuries are pretty extensive. The type of bullets that were used in the Vegas shooting were hollow point bullets, which means they explode or shatter on impact. And I was told that these were modified, so I don't know exactly what the difference of those would be, but my bullet that hit me, the bullet that hit me just fell out of the sky, basically, and hit me in the back. And so when it shattered on impact, it fractured two of my vertebrae, and it hit my abdominal aorta, which runs right in front of the spine. So it hit my abdominal aorta. It hit my kidney, my left kidney, my liver, my stomach, and my spleen. So I had damage to multiple organs, and my stomach had several holes in it, and was all of the food I had eaten that day was, you know, emptying into my abdomen. And so that's why I was vomiting. I was very ill from the pain and from the fact that my organs weren't keeping things where they needed to.
Right.
So the gist of it is the abdominal aorta has a lot of pressure in it, and that's the biggest artery of our body. And so when mine was hit, I should have died within about 2 minutes, probably, because even the smallest little nick in it, the vacuum pressure and the, you know, just the amount of the pressure going through the aorta, it would have ripped it apart and I would have bled to death. But it took about 2 hours for me to get from the shooting to the hospital. And then when I got to the hospital, I was still stable. So all along the way that they're checking me, there was like a little triage point behind the Tropicana Hotel, which is where I ended up. And that's where I was taken to the hospital from. But they had checked my vitals there several times. And then there were volunteers, you know, starting IVs, doing like the blocks. So that way, when you got to, you know, the hospital, they could start medication faster or put you under immediately. So there were nurses and military and firefighters, paramedics, EMTs that were just at the concert who were volunteering to help save lives. And so that is definitely a blessing, because when I got to the hospital, I was still stable. So they kind of just left me in the hallway on a gurney, but I was crying in pain. And all along this whole journey, you know, I'm on the phone back and forth with my boyfriend, Mark, and he immediately got in his truck and started driving to Vegas. But, you know, it's a good 3-hour drive. So this whole journey, you know, we're talking back and forth, and I was able to text just a few people, because like you said, you had tried calling, and there were so many people calling and texting. And I thought to myself, laying in the hospital, man, how does everyone know? Wow, this is fast. And so that's the beauty of social media. Like you said, you're scrolling through, and then next thing you know, on Facebook, you're like, oh my gosh, there's a shooting in Vegas. Oh, hey, I know someone there. And so that's the beauty of it. And in some ways, it has allowed us to connect with people and know things about people much faster. So it's not all, you know, hard and negative. But you know, laying in the hospital, I kept thinking like, oh my gosh, I can't respond to everyone. So I did send a few messages to a few people, and bless their hearts. Some of them, well, two of them, the only thing they got from me was I got shot, and that was it. There was nothing after that. And so my friends were just devastated and scared, not knowing anything. Right. But it's interesting in time of tragedy, what happens is I was trying to think about what it is that I needed to do. So I wasn't able to move, and I was having a hard time struggling to talk because I was in a lot of pain and struggling to stay awake, but laying in the hallway of the emergency room at the hospital and all this chaos going around me, you know, I looked over and I saw that there were a few ladies standing there with iPads, and they were registration clerks. So I called one of them over and I said, can you please start registering me? Because if someone calls looking for me, I need them to know that I'm here. I need family to know that I'm here. And I had already told Mark, who was on his way, what hospital I was at, because I was awake when, you know, through all of this. And when I got put into an ambulance and I asked the EMT, where are you taking me? And he told me what hospital. I was able to let people know where I was. So I told the registration clerk, I was like, I need people to know I'm here, because I know that there was several people that had no idea where I was or if I was safe. And so that way, when people were calling hospitals, they would be able to find me. And so she started to register me, but she got pulled away. So she started my registration, but didn't get to complete it. And then this whole time I'm in horrible pain. It was horrific. Definitely worse than childbirth, but I had stopped a nurse who was running past me and I was begging her for some pain medication. I had asked for some pain medication in the ambulance and the EMT had told me, you know, it's not my main concern. You know, I really have to get your line started and I have to do this and do this. And I told him, I said, please, you don't understand how much pain I'm in. It was horrible. So he gave me a shot of morphine as we got to the hospital and the hospital staff was pulling me out on the gurney and he said, hold on. I promised her I'd give her this. So he did give me a shot of morphine in my IV that I got started behind the Tropicana. And I think that lasted maybe 15 minutes, 10, 15 minutes. It didn't last very long, but it did give me a little bit of relief and I was grateful for that. But as I'm in the hallway of the emergency room, you know, my vitals had already been checked. And this is mass chaos. I can't even tell you and put into words how horrible it was, and people running around and people are screaming, not only in pain, but hospital staff and doctors and nurses are screaming for help because, you know, people are they're dying. And I remember them taking my vitals yet again. And she was like, you know, you're okay, you're stable. And I told this nurse, I said, I'm in so much pain, please, can you give me something? And they originally said they weren't giving pain medication because it would mask our symptoms. And they wanted to know when they did treat us, what was going on with us. And I said, well, I've been stable this whole time, which praise God, with a hole in my aorta, my vitals are stable. I mean, a little off, but for the most part, I'm doing okay. And for someone who should have died in 2 minutes, 2 hours later, my vitals are stable. Only God could do something that amazing.
Right. It's a true miracle for sure.
Absolutely. And no one understands how. And everyone, all of my doctors, everyone always says, you know, it's God above. And I absolutely agree. But in that moment when, you know, I'm thinking, how long am I going to lay here? And still not knowing if I'm going to survive. I'm assuming now that I'm at the hospital, I'm going to be okay. Like I've kind of calmed myself enough to think, okay, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be okay. But I stopped this nurse and I said, please, please, please give me some medicine. And she was like, oh, I don't think we're supposed to. And she was like, well, what's going on? Where were you shot? And she's asking me these questions. And she's like, I told her, I said I was shot in the back, but my pain was in my stomach. I felt like someone was ripping my insides from me. It was so painful and it was sharp and it was unlike anything I could even tell you. I mean, it basically did feel like someone was reaching into my abdomen and pulling my insides out. So she had said, but you were shot in the back? And I was like, yes. And I kept thinking to myself, okay, lady, we do not have time for this song and dance. Shot in the back, my stomach hurts. Give me something. And so she's like, let's check your vitals. And so she actually had checked my vitals just a few minutes prior. And every time they check our vitals, they were writing our vitals on us. So they would take our blood pressure and our pulse, and they were writing on us, all of us victims who were actually, you know, who were injured. They were writing on us. So I had on a tank top, and they were writing all down my arms and on my chest. And for the deceased, they were, you know, they had to mark them if they had passed. You know, she's looking at my vitals from the previous times they had taken them. And then she's like, okay, well, let's do it one more time. And I thought, no, you just took them. I'm stable. Give me some pain meds. Like, just give them to me. Come on. And so she was like, well, let's just do it one more time. And so she took my blood pressure that last time. And she's like, oh my God, you're dying. And I thought, what?
Wow.
What? what? Wait, I thought I was stable. What are you talking about? And all of this happened very quickly. She pulled my gurney away from the wall of the ER hallway, and she pushed me. I'm looking at the ceiling and feels like I'm flying down the hallway, and she's screaming, "We're losing her," and running down the hallway. All of these doctors come out of a room, and they pull the gurney into what was triage, an actual triage room. And there are several other people in there, lots of other doctors. And everyone's just kind of calling out orders, and she's rambling off my vitals, which were so low at that point. I want to say she said it was like 50 over 20 something, my blood pressure, which our normal is 120 over 70.
Right.
So my blood pressure went in a matter of minutes from being somewhat normal to being almost gone. I had no blood pressure left, which means I was bleeding to death internally. My aorta was now losing all of the blood. So they're throwing bags of blood on my legs, and everyone's calling out all these orders. And I'm looking up and I'm like, "Well, somebody please give me something for this pain, please." And I'm begging. And this little female doctor stood over the top of my head, and she's like, "You're in pain. You're in pain. You hurt." And I said, "Yes, please, please do something, anything." And she's like, "Okay, we'll make it stop. We'll make all the pain go away." And so she hollered for, you know, some medication, and they put it through my IV. And that was the last thing I remember until I woke up. And so it wasn't until 4 days later, they were able to take me off of the ventilator and wake me up. But during this time, I had a four or six hour surgery to fix all of the damage done to my body. And those bullet parts went everywhere. I mean, like I said, that bullet shattered on impact, and all of those pieces went somewhere and damaged something. And so I was blessed to get a pediatric surgeon, two pediatric surgeons, actually, instead of just a trauma surgeon, because in mass casualty like that, they call in everybody, anybody and everybody, they call them all in. And so the doctor that I got for surgery was a pediatric surgeon, and he refused to stop trying to save my life, which is another just God thing, because trauma doctors are trained to save as many people as possible. So when you see somebody be like me, who's pretty much already dead, you know, they're like, "Oh, there's no hope, you know, we just got to let her go and move on." But this doctor didn't do that. And he spent several hours making sure he saved my life. And it's really kind of cool. What he did is that he taped a paperclip to my entry wound. And my entry wound is so tiny. You can barely even see it. It's like a little tiny, it looks almost like a chicken pox scar on my back. And he taped a paperclip to it, and they had opened me from the front, and they did a CAT scan of me laying on the operating table to see each piece of the bullet, each fragment of the bullet, to see, kind of trace its path, to see where it went and what it damaged. Because the doctors say that every time they would sew up something, I would bleed more from somewhere else. So it's pretty intense, which there are many things in my story and what happened that night that only God could have been orchestrating. Because initially, when we walked out of the venue, you know, these tiny little Orange County cute girls are trying to carry me. And I'm corn fed from the Midwest. I'm not exactly tiny, and you know, they're struggling to carry me, and there's a wheelchair just randomly outside the venue. And so I hollered, "Oh my gosh, go get that wheelchair." And they were able to push me in the wheelchair versus trying to carry me all that way. And then when I first got into the ambulance, they had told me that I was going to go to the University Hospital in Vegas. And then all of a sudden the EMT is like, "Oh, no, wait, you're not going there. You're going to go to Sunrise." And so if I had gone to University, I maybe probably would have gotten a trauma surgeon. But instead, I went to Sunrise, where they have this huge children's hospital. And that's why I was able to get a pediatric surgeon who worked on me. And so my first surgery was several hours. When I came out of surgery, they had left my abdomen open, and they had put me on a wound vac, which keeps, you know, everything clean and sealed. But they had done that initially because they weren't sure if my stomach was going to need to be sewn up more, or if the swelling was so massive because there's so many organs involved. But then they were also afraid that they were going to have to go in and take out my left kidney because the bullet had destroyed the artery to my left kidney to the point where they didn't think that it was something that they could save. But they went ahead and tried, and they thought, well, we've got a lever open anyway, so if we have to go back in and take out that kidney, we will. But the amazing thing is I had my second surgery, and they closed everything up, and I didn't lose anything.
That is amazing.
It's amazing. I did lose part of my stomach, but it wasn't quite the tummy tuck that I wanted after having a baby.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I'm extremely lucky. I got to keep all of my organs. And the awesome part is that I had these doctors that I would have never had in a million years. I mean, what are the odds that the next patient who came in, they just said, hey, you guys take her? Because there were several, I know that there were a few people who went into surgery, and I don't know how quickly they were in and out with them, but, you know, despite their efforts, they didn't make it. So I'm incredibly grateful that the doctors that I got, the surgeons that I got, they took their time. And they made sure that they saved my life. And, you know, these doctors at the time didn't know I had a little boy. They didn't, you know, my son was 6 at the time of the shooting. They didn't know I was a single mom. They didn't know anything about me because they were not there when they put me under. And they didn't know. They just, I was handed to them, and they did everything they could to save my life, which is so amazing. And so I think that, you know, like I said before, is just a continuation of my journey of how these things that may be horrible happen, but it's all supposed to be for, you know, it's supposed to be used for good. And we're not supposed to understand why these things happen and understand exactly the reason for them. But I can tell you that we have choices in life, and we can choose to focus on the bad. And we can choose to be sad always, which sadness is always going to come. Or we can try to find the good and the positive in everything. And some days it's hard. And some days I don't want to be positive. And some days I'm like, nope, today is not a positive day. I'm just going to be negative all day. And that's okay sometimes. But I think that it's very important that we try to focus on the positive and understand that in all of this horror and all of the continued shootings and horror that we see and horrible things that are going on in the world, and even just, you know, the battles between countries and different stuff like that. It's like, well, one, why do we keep continuing this horrible pattern? But two, what can we pull from it? What can we learn from it? You know, and I can tell you that it's hard, but when you choose to find the good, there's a lot more that you can do with that instead of being negative every day. So I can share my story and I can tell people, you know, like I went through some of the most horrific things, but God saved me for something. And I think that I absolutely truly believe that was to share the story to help people through whatever tragedies they may be going through. And it could be the loss of a family member in a shooting, in the Vegas shooting, any other time. I've been so blessed to help people when they lose grandparents or parents or, you know, anybody, or not even just losing anybody, just the journey of motherhood itself through divorce or through car accidents or anything, near life death experience. You know, it's just, there's so many different things that we're all going through. And that's the positive point, is that no one is ever alone. I may not know how someone else feels, and they may not know how I feel, but they're not alone. And I think the best thing that anybody has ever said to me this whole process of being a shooting victim survivor is that it's okay to not be okay, and it's okay to feel the way you feel.
Yes.
It's okay. So, you know, the main point of the shootings that are happening is that no matter what you believe in, the reality is that guns don't fire themselves. There's people behind them. And when people are making these choices to harm other people, they're not mentally well. They're not at all. And the mental health of our country is sad, and it's dwindling. And there's so much negativity that goes around asking for help. It's like when I got shot, I didn't say, oh, no, I'll be okay. I'll be all right. Just leave me be. Mm-hmm. No, I'm screaming, help, please help. And I think that because mental health isn't something that we physically are bleeding to death from, I think that that's why there's been so much negativity around asking for help. We forget that we need to ask for help in many ways. And so that is definitely the main reason, you know, that I like to share my story, whether it just be about Vegas or life in general, because all of these things that happen to us are life events. These are all things that we can't go through alone. And I truly believe that that's not what God intended for us either. He didn't intend for us to be alone and to go through these things alone. He intended on us to go through them with Him, to call upon Him and use our support, whether it's family or friends or medical professionals or, you know, sometimes strangers. Mm-hmm. And I got 5 strangers who risked their lives for me to save me.
And it seems like they were all sent. Everything that happened was just sent to help you survive.
Absolutely.
And their lives have been changed as well, knowing like, hey, I helped her. She's alive with her son because of me.
And I can't say that I know what that feeling feels like, but I'm glad that they have that feeling because I am incredibly grateful and so grateful. And I know that a lot of people, they still struggle. You know, a lot of us survivors still struggle. There are a lot of survivors who they ran and didn't necessarily pick anybody up and throw them over a fence or pick someone up and carry them out. There were a lot of people and a lot of people ran, and that needed to happen for us all to get out. But I know a lot of survivors feel guilty for not staying and helping. But the reality is everything happened just as it should have. And everybody's path that night and end result was different. And why we can't explain why, but I can tell you that looking at what we have now and how to move forward from here, whether, you know, we're a survivor of a shooting or we're a mom who lost a baby or someone who lost anybody or suffered some kind of injury in any way, is that we have to keep moving forward. And I think that for me, it's easy to say that because I'm a mom and I don't have any other choice but to move forward and to keep pushing and fighting. And so, I mean, due to my son, I was able to get better faster. So with all the damage done to my body and all the organs that were affected, I was only in the hospital for 30 days total.
Wow.
And so that's pretty amazing to me. I was in Vegas for 18 days and then they transferred me to a rehab at Loma Linda, and I was there for 12 days. And the first time that I got to see my son, I think total, it had been 24 days that I hadn't seen him. And that's the longest I've ever been away from him in his whole life. You know, as a chiropractor and having to take classes and do continuing education, I had gone away for a weekend a few times, but the longest I'd ever been away from him was 3 or 4 days. And that was hard as it was. And I remember the first time I saw him and he walked into my room at Loma Linda and he started to cry and he was like, "Mommy, you look a little different." And I said, "Yeah, but I'm still your mommy." And it was just, there's no other choice for me, you know, but to get better and to keep fighting and to be strong, because I couldn't just give up. My son needed me. And whether we have kids or not, there's someone who needs us. We all have our purpose in life. And so I was so grateful to be able to come home. And I came home to friends who were helping me. I wasn't able to drive, was very weak. I didn't have to relearn to walk, but I did have to work on walking again, climbing stairs. But I would compete with another survivor at Loma Linda Rehab. It was funny. He is a San Bernardino County deputy. And so us being both headstrong, it was cute. I'm like, okay, how far can we walk today? How many stairs can we climb today? And a little uncompetition is what helped us get stronger so that we could both go home sooner. I'm just so grateful. And I hope that my story touches someone. I did a CBS interview. My therapist and I did a CBS interview at the 6-month mark. They had approached my therapist and asked her if she would do an interview on mental health and how survivors are doing nowadays and, you know, 6 months out, what it looks like for us. Mm-hmm. So she said, yeah, and she would love to. And my therapist at CBS knew that she had several survivors that she saw, but she said one of my survivors was actually shot And my therapist and I had decided early on in my journey after I had been shot that we wanted to write a book and tell everyone my story, what had happened, and how the therapy that I did and how it affected me and changed me, because I wasn't positive coming home. I mean, there was so much happening in my life before I got shot. I was going through a divorce and a custody battle and dating again and transitioning into, you know, a new house with my son, you know, and him going back and forth between his dad. And I had been involved in a hit and run accident right before the shooting. And then I got my car back from the accident. And then a huge tree fell on my car at my office and swallowed my car and did a lot of damage to it. So there was a lot leading up to that. So when I came home from the hospital, I wasn't very positive. I was grateful to be alive, but I wasn't positive. And I was very down. And I thought, wow, like pity party, like, why me? Why is this all happening to me? What did I do? I'm a good person. And my therapist and I decided we wanted to share that story so that maybe we could touch somebody someday. So we decided to write a book early on. So when CBS came to her to ask her to do a 6-month follow-up, she shared with them that we were writing a book and that, you know, I was shot and I'm a survivor, and they wanted to talk to both of us. And so we did an interview for CBS, and it actually didn't turn out the way that we had hoped. And they had twisted it. It was supposed to be about mental health, awareness about mental health. And I want to take the negative away from that. It's not negative. We all have different things we're struggling with. So instead of it being about surviving and mental health and how we're feeling and how we're doing 6 months later, it turned into me getting shot and what happened that night. And, you know, luckily they saved a few lines of something that we talked about mental health, but it didn't end up being that. And I was really upset about it. And I remember telling my therapist, I said, I'm really sorry. I feel like I hijacked your interview. This was supposed to be about, you know, you and the work that you're doing to spread awareness about mental health so more people will get help. And my therapist told me, she said, you know, it is what it is. You know, we now know, you know, there's always a hidden agenda. And now we know going forward. But she said, if we touch one single person with our interview, then it wasn't a waste. And so my therapist actually got a call about a week after the interview, and it was from a lady who lives somewhere in LA area. And she does not know anybody that was a victim or the survivor of the Vegas shooting. She actually called because her daughter had been raped the year prior and was struggling with recovery and, you know, the damage done to her mentally along with physically. And so she said, if this lady can help that survivor of the Vegas shooting get better and help her cope, then she can help my daughter who is struggling from a completely different tragedy. And that actually touched my heart and made me so happy because, like I said, it doesn't have to just be us survivors from the Vegas shooting. It can be anybody. And it did. It made a difference. This, you know, this lady who, you know, suffered this horrible incident that happened to her. Rape is horrid. She was struggling and she had tried to get help, but, you know, wasn't getting what she needed. And my therapist was able to help them get through that and help her make changes in that. That is what it's all about. This is what the journey of life is supposed to be, and the journey of motherhood and the journey of life. It's about helping each other and getting each other through. And so that really, really helped me. I've learned, and as you've said before, Veronica, I'm healing through healing others. Yeah. And so I feel like that's been my whole life, you know, going back to the main point is that I've always healed from healing other people. So healing from, you know, my birth experience, healing from being separated and becoming a single mom and going through a divorce. I heal all of those things that happen to me through healing other people and just touching them with my story and adjusting them and making changes to their bodies so that they can adapt to whatever it is that they're going through. All of that it's beautiful that God has blessed me with that ability to not only make changes to their body, but make changes to their heart through my story. So every day is different. Of course, I don't jump out of bed and say, hooray for another day. I usually roll out crying from pain. I have pain every day, and I still require medication every day just to get out of bed and put on my clothes and function. I wasn't able to work for a while. I think that God blessed me with the ability to get stronger much faster so that I could start working on babies here and there and doing what I needed to here and there. But I could be watching my son grow up from above instead of being right here next to him. And that is the beauty of this whole story, is that when there's no explanation for why I get to be here except for God, it doesn't matter because I'm here, you know, and I don't need to know why, and I don't need to understand, you know, why the guy did what he did, or, you know, why we don't really have answers for things. I don't really care, and I don't need to know why, because all I know is that I'm moving forward. Every day I'm going to continue to get stronger and to work on being me and adapting to a new way of life. I'm lucky in the fact that I'm not wheelchair bound, and I can still do a lot of the activities, most of the activities that I did before the shooting. I just can't do everything at the same level. And so adapting to having different abilities and different amount of energy, and my pain limits some of the things that I could do, I'm struggling with that. But in the end, it's just all about continuing on.
And I'm glad that you said that, because I was going to ask you how you feel now physically, mentally, but you already laid it all out there. And every day is a struggle. And yeah, I see you and I think, oh, she looks great. But every day is a struggle.
It is, most definitely. And I actually am glad that you said that, because I think that's where I struggle most, is that I look fine, you know, other than I look, you know, depending on what's going on, I may have the look of pain on my face, or I look tired. But sometimes that's just motherhood. Mm-hmm. And so you can't tell the difference, but I do.
And then on top of that, your work is very physical.
It is indeed. You know, I use my body to change other people. And so it is very physical what I do. And I think that the fact that I look fine, it makes it hard for people to understand what it is that I go through every day. But, you know, my son and my significant other, you know, they watch me cry at the end of the day, or come home and barely make it to the couch to pass out. Or, you know, Mark is up with me all night long because I'm crying in pain. And it's pretty much a nightly thing that I have this pain that never goes away.
And I know that you were worried about becoming dependent on the medication.
Well, I definitely worry about it for sure, because I do require, you know, opiates every day just to get out of bed. And I don't feel that I actually crave them. So I'm good in that department, thank goodness, because it is a big struggle in our world today. And our country has a very big problem with opiate dependence. But I did struggle with actually needing them to get out of bed. I kept thinking, like, I can't live my life like this. And there was a period of time where I tried to suffer through without them. And I actually went back to Vegas last year to visit my doctors and nurses who took care of me. And I had this amazing nurse when I was in ICU, and she is the reason that I did so well. Her name is Marlena. She is my angel from above, because she also caught an infection in my wound that the trauma doctors were basically ignoring at the time, or my trauma resident, I should say, at Sunrise. He was ignoring it, and he thought, oh, it's just staph. We'll just give her some basic antibiotics. But she was like, it's not staph. And she actually waited until my pediatric surgeon came around to visit me. He would just come and see me every so often. And so she actually waited for him to come, and she said, can you culture this? And she had him sign off on all the labs she wanted to run. And it was a good thing she did, because I would have died from that infection. So she saved my life. But then she also got me up and moving. She got my pain meds increased, because initially I was on a very low dose of pain medication. I'm not sure why my trauma resident was being so headstrong. He initially had said he didn't want me to become constipated and dependent on the drugs, but I was only 5 days out of surgery and crying in pain. So she was able to, you know, get my pain medication to a level that managed my pain. And she got me up and she got me moving and walking. And so when I went back to Vegas last year, I visited her and I brought her a bracelet that says angel on it, and guardian angel, and has like a little verse on it. And I told her, I'm like, you are the reason why I was able to go back home and take care of my son and, you know, go home and still practice. Although my level of moving around has decreased, I'm still able to move around. And so talking with her, I would tell her my concerns about the medication. And her fiance was in a horrible accident. He was thrown from an off-road vehicle and he had suffered a major artery damage as well. So he told me the same thing. He said, you know, some days I want to just not take those pills because I don't want to be dependent on them. And I want to be able to get out of bed and not feel like I have to use those. And he said for 3 days he suffered and didn't take his medication. And he said it was the worst 3 days of my life and I had no quality of life and I couldn't get out of bed. So he said, you know what? If 2 or 3 pills a day is what it takes for me to have a decent quality of life, then it's worth it. And I thought, you know, that's right. You know, that's true. I have a young child and he can't watch his mom lay in bed and cry all day. And I need to get up and take him to school. And I want to be present for his school functions. And I want to pick him up from school and I want to take him to the park. I want to be his mom. And that's the reason why I'm here. So if that means taking a few pills a day, then it means taking a few pills a day.
Right.
And I've had to let go of that. I think control is a big issue that I have. Mm-hmm. As moms tend to want to control it all. But mm-hmm. the reality is I can't control it all and I can't make it go away. So the best thing that I can do is figure out how to live the best that I can with, you know, with what I have now. So I would assume that someone who, you know, lost their ability to walk or lost a limb or, you know, I know that there was a survivor who lost an eye. I can't speak to that, but I can say that as a survivor in my situation where I look fine, the hardest part is trying to get others to understand that I'm not the Dr. Amanda I was before I got shot. I'm not the mom I was before I got shot. I'm not, you know, the spouse or significant other I was before I got shot. I'm a completely different person. And while I look fine, it's still a struggle. And I urge everyone, whether they're struggling or not, to remember to be kind to everyone, because, you know, the saying that we don't know what their battle may be. Everyone right. is having, you know, everyone's going through something. We don't know what their struggle is that day. And I tend to look fine most days, but almost every day there's something, there's a struggle, whether it be physically or mentally, or trying to be a mom and a business owner and work and, you know, survive something tragic. It's a whole lot for just one person. Even without the tragic part and without the tragedy and the survivor part, it's a lot. Us moms, whether we're single moms or we have spouses or significant others or we have family members, you know, motherhood's a challenge. Right. It definitely is. I came home from the hospital on a Monday afternoon and my ex-husband informed me that I needed to pick my son up immediately. So I was not afforded the opportunity to just rest when I got home. I was thrown into motherhood again. And I kept thinking like, oh, that was probably the hardest thing ever is that I said, I can't, mm-hmm. I have never said those words before. I can't take care of my son. I physically cannot take care of him because I couldn't take care of myself for mm-hmm. the longest time. I couldn't even be alone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and my significant other had to go back to work. He actually was off for more than 30 days and was with me in the hospital every single day. He was wow. with me every single day. And when we got home from the hospital, he had to go back to work. But somebody has to go to work. So my brother flew in from Missouri, my older brother, Keith, because that's where I'm from. I was born and raised in the Midwest. So my brother lives back home in Missouri and he had flown into Vegas for a week and then flew home. And then when I came home from the hospital, he was able to be here for a few days. So I arranged with my ex-husband to pick my son up. I think it was Friday. So I came home on a Monday and he told me, my ex-husband had told me like, well, you need to come and get him because I've had him for a month and it's too much. You know, I'm trying to work and my parents and my ex-in-laws, you know, were helping with him, my son at the time. But my ex-husband lived in Chino Hills and my son went to school in Corona. So the drive for his parents was a lot in the morning. And so I told my ex-husband, I said, you know, you're just going to have to figure it out for a few more days because I can't take care of him and I can't take care of myself. You know, I was having home health come in. I went home with an open wound. So since I had the infection, I actually came home with an open wound, and it wasn't until I think it was right before Christmas, my wound finally closed all the way. So I came home with an open wound. I came home with home health to clean my wound. I came home with physical therapy, home health, because I wasn't able to walk without the use of a device at first. So I was using a walker and different things, and I wasn't even able to stand and shower myself. So I had family members and friends, friends that I consider family members, I should say, come over showering me and, you know, brushing my hair, taking care of me. So I was scared of how I was going to care for my child. So when my brother flew in from Missouri and we went and picked up my son, I was scared. That was the first time that I was honestly scared to take care of him. I was scared to be a mom because I thought, I don't know if I can do it. I'm too weak and I can't. And luckily, you know, at 6, he was a big help. He was excited to be home in his own house and his own bed. And he missed me and wanted to just take care of me, this little boy with a heart of gold. And I'm looking at him thinking, I don't know if I can take care of you, baby. Mm-hmm. And that was probably one of the scariest things that I had to admit to myself. But that is important for us to remember, whether we're physically ill, mentally ill, whatever the case may be, that it's okay to admit that we need help. And yeah. I did need help. So luckily I had friends. My brother was in for a few days and then he had to fly back to Missouri because he has kids of his own. And every day I had friends come over who helped me get him dressed for school, helped me pack his lunch, helped me get dressed. And then they drove us to my son's school to drop him off. And then the same thing after school, they would drive me to pick him up. And I was still able to take my son and drop him off at school. And that was the first step to healing and becoming a mom, because a lot of times I get a lot of questions like, is it hard? What was the hardest part? You know, was it the pain or is it the nightmares or PTSD or is it the anxiety when you go in public? And I can honestly tell you that the hardest thing of all of this was being away from my baby boy and then thinking that I couldn't be his mom anymore, that I couldn't care for him. So every day I just work towards being better at doing just that. And if it means taking a pill, it means taking a pill. If it means I need more therapy that week, and then I go, you know, I call my therapist and I try to get in. Or, you know, if it means I need a mental health day and I don't do anything and I don't leave my house and I don't get off the couch and I don't get out of my pajamas, then I don't do that. Whatever it is that I need that day, that's what I shoot for. And so I'm extremely grateful in the fact that I've had such a great support team. So many people who just came out and helped me. And I think it's truly beautiful. My brother made the comment to my significant other, Mark. He was telling him, he said, you know, Amanda walks into a room and she can make friends and she keeps them for a lifetime. And I think that that's just because I've been able to share my journey of what's happened, not just in the Vegas shooting, but just through motherhood and divorce and chiropractic school and just life and family stuff. And I'm able to share that and it touches someone. And just like I have been touched by someone else's story. And I think that you make a connection with people and you keep that for a lifetime. And I think that that's been my saving grace, is having that support system and being so blessed by everyone. In my practice for 4 months, there were doctors that volunteered and I only knew two of them. Every day for 4 months, there was a different doctor in every morning and every afternoon, and people volunteered. When I woke up in the hospital 4 days after the shooting, I got taken off the ventilator. The first thing my brother said to me was, Jason is okay. And there are people working in your office. And I was thinking, what? What do you mean there's people working in my office? And then I found out that all of these doctors volunteered their time to not only care for my community, because my patients just aren't my patients. They don't come in and pay my bills. They're my family and my community. And all of my patients, and you included, Veronica, everyone came together to support me. Everyone did fundraisers. T-shirts were made with the hashtag Dr. Amanda Strong on it. And everyone pulled together, and my patients trusted, you know, going in to see these doctors to keep my business alive, mm-hmm. for one, but two, to continue to care for the community that I was a part of, that I was so blessed to have, you know? And so just as I have helped my community all came together and helped me. And yeah. So I think that that's beautiful. And I think that that's amazing. And I think that in every tragedy, we'll see something like that. And that's what I want to spread, is the continued love and the continued community and the continued blessing. And so I'm grateful for that.
Yes. Yeah. Your community is strong. It's there for you. And it's because you put in so much work towards other people that everybody wanted to also help you, including your son helped you.
He did.
Well, thank you so much for sharing your time with me. In case anybody wanted to reach out for you, what would be the platform that they can reach you on?
You can reach out to me via social media. I have an Instagram page. It's Dr. Amanda DC. And I also do have a website. It's www.dramandadc.com. On there, you can send me an email if you have questions, or questions about us being a survivor, questions about my practice, questions about motherhood. It doesn't have to be that you want an appointment to come into my office. It can be about anything. My end goal eventually is to have community night where we can get together and just share stories and have like motherhood therapy.
Yeah. So that sounds great.
It doesn't just sound good. We all need that support. Yeah. And that's why I love your podcast, Veronica, is that real life is hard and you share stories. And I think, wow, you know, I can't imagine going through that. And I know that people feel that way about my story. And I think that that's where we, you know, we learn and we grow and we help each other by hearing other struggles and seeing how they overcome. And sometimes we are still struggling and sharing stories about something else from that you heard from someone else can help us. So it doesn't have to be just reaching out to me to get an appointment. It can be about anything. And so that's why, yes, I'm so incredibly grateful for you having me on as a guest, because I want us all to stick together and be there for each other. Like everyone has been there for me. I want to make sure that I repay that back.
Yes. And Dr. Amanda is a great resource of information. I'll definitely link everything in the show notes for sure. And thank you so much for your words. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you again for having me. I appreciate it.